This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Together, let's get Washington to work. That's what Governor Rick Scott told supporters in Orlando at the launch of his Senate campaign yesterday. The slogan echoes the jobs, jobs, jobs mantra that Scott has highlighted throughout his term as governor. But is his record as governor enough to propel him into the Senate? What do you think of a Senator Rick Scott? What issues are important to you heading to the ballot box in November, whether it's the environment, gun regulation, job creation, or education? Are you happy with Senator Bill Nelson's work in the Senate, or do you agree that a change is needed? We're taking your calls. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send in your comments and questions on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. And joining us this morning, Sergio Bustos. He's a senior editor with Politico Florida. Sergio, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
We're also joined by Adam Goodman. He's a national GOP strategist and president of the Victory Group out of Tampa, St. Petersburg. Adam, thank you as well for being on the program.
Great to be here.
And Steve Shale, Democratic political strategist and president of Shale Strategies in Tallahassee. Steve, thank you as well.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
And you can join the conversation, that number again, 1-866-338-5252. Send in your comments on Twitter as well. We're over at WMFE Orlando. Well, at his campaign launch yesterday, Governor Scott called Washington a disaster and dysfunctional. Let's hear a little bit of the tape there.
You know, I didn't fit into Tallahassee because I didn't play the insider games. I never intended to fit into Tallahassee, and guess what? I'm not going to fit into Washington either.
He also talked about his record as governor. He stressed job creation.
So let's think of what we've done in the last 7 years in this state. Almost 1.5 million jobs. $10 billion in tax reductions. Yeah. Over $9 billion in debt reductions in this state. We've cut regulations. We've streamlined the permitting process. We've had over a 40% increase in tourism just in 7 years.
Well, that's Governor Rick Scott talking about his record in Tallahassee over the last 7 years. What do you think about his record? Does it translate to a senator? Is he the person you want to see up in the Senate? Do you think he's a good replacement for Bill Nelson? Are you happy with the way things are? We'd like to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also send us in your comments via Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Sergio Bustos with Politico Florida, I want to come to you first. What stuck out for you about the campaign launch? What were you expecting to hear, and was there anything that you didn't hear that you thought you should have?
I thought it was the location that stood out to me. You know, he got there in the heart of the I-4 corridor up in Orlando. He had the Puerto Rican lieutenant governor come out for him. You know, he even spoke a few words in Spanish, which they were mangled a bit, but he gave it a try. You know, just the location of where he launched it from says a lot about what he wants to do.
And that sort of speaks to the change in tack, I guess, the change in, you know, the position he's going for compared to when he ran as governor and he launched his campaign in the villages and he was sort of running on that Tea Party platform. What do you think about that? What have we seen that's different about Governor Scott in the last 7 years, and how, I guess, natural has that evolution been?
I'm not sure if it's been natural or simply caused by events. You know, I remember right from the beginning, he had to pivot on education because he was getting so much pushback from it. And here at the end of his two terms, it's interesting because he did make a huge effort to reach out to Puerto Ricans following Hurricane Maria. And then his move on the gun bill, mm-hmm. Following the tragedy at Parkland, Florida, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. He did a pivot there too, challenged the NRA.
But
I think he's been evolving ever since.
Mm-hmm. If I could just interject there, though, I mean, you will hear critics on the gun issue saying, why didn't you do that, Governor Scott, after the shooting at Pulse in Orlando? So there is a little bit of inconsistency there that some of his critics and of course, people who are in the Democratic camp and running and, you know, pushing Bill Nelson's campaign are going to pick up on and highlight.
There's no doubt, but I think the attention span of voters is like...
We seem to have dropped out with Sergio there. We'll try and get him back on the line, but in the meantime...
We will.
Oh, he's back. Okay. Sorry, you just finish your thought there. We just lost you for a moment, Sergio.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. he can certainly, you know, the voters are always going to remember, what have you done for me lately?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, his opponent, Nelson's going to charge him with, go back to the Pulse shooting. You wonder why nothing was done there.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of fodder there for Nelson to attack.
Mm-hmm. Adam Goodman with Victory Strategies, if I could bring you into this conversation. You know, attack ads have already started. They're hammering Scott over his record on gun safety, as we said, jobs, Medicaid expansion. You know, pick your poison, I guess, if you're looking at it from the governor's point of view. What sort of weaknesses does Rick Scott have, and how do you expect his campaign to defend against some of these attack ads?
That's a great question. A couple things. Number one is, when you talk about ads in general in Florida, they're projecting that we're going to see over $100 million spent easily in the Senate race. Then on top of that, we could see the same number in the governor's race. There are major competitive races for Congress and up and down the ladder. The clutter here is going to be immense. Every time you turn on the television by the 1st of June, it's going to be politics 24/7. So what impact will the negative ads have? I'm not sure. But this much is clear from what we've all experienced over the last 12 months in Florida and in other places around the country. There's been a sea change. Races that were competitive in Florida in 2017 seemed to see every Republican go down because the polling was never quite on point, given the turnout among Democrats was up, way up over historical measures. And this race, as much as that, I think the coming out party for Rick Scott, I think was actually well messaged. I mean, I think that was the message he had to try to sell. The outsider, no one owns me. I'll take on Washington like I took on Tallahassee. The reality of this campaign is that it's going to be a referendum on the president.
Mm-hmm.
It was a referendum on the president in every race in Florida in 2017. It will be in 18. He is tied at the hip with Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might say his efforts to try to create a little bit of distance, like he's just going to do the right thing against the system, whatever that means, is going to run headlong into a very long track record of Rick Scott being in complete lockstep with the president. So at the end of the day, this verdict, I think, is going to be how people feel, as much how they feel about Donald Trump in late October as they do about the incumbent governor.
Talking to Adam Goodman there with Victory Strategies, national GOP consultant. We're talking about the Senate race. Rick Scott throwing his hat in the ring, a widely expected announcement that came yesterday in Orlando. Steve Schell, I want to bring you into this conversation. Let me just read something from Bill Nelson. He had a little statement about Scott's Senate bid. He says, quote, "I've always run every race like there's no tomorrow, regardless of my opponent. Well, it's clear that Rick Scott will say or do anything to get elected. I've always believed that if you just do the right thing, the politics will take care of itself." End quote. What do you think of that, Steve Schell? Is that going to be enough to win the race for re-election for Senator Bill Nelson?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things. I mean, first of all, I agree completely with Adam. I mean, if you look at the last three midterm elections, 06, 10, and 14, each one of them has been a referendum on the incumbent president. And when people are frustrated with Washington in a midterm, the only way that they can express that frustration is to vote against people of the president's party. And, you know, as Adam said, Trump is sort of very tied to Trump. Scott's very tied to Trump. But even if he wasn't, we've certainly seen candidates here in Florida in 2017 who ran away from Trump in their elections and still lost. Again, because it's more the symbolic message voters can send. Beyond that, I mean, I think, you know, Nelson often gets underestimated. I mean, all this guy's done is won five consecutive statewide elections in a state like Florida. And Nelson, you know, if you think about it in a football term, you know, he's sort of the running back that has a nose for the goal line. I mean, mm-hmm. It's never going to be pretty. He's never going to win by a lot, but he sort of knows how to get the ball across the line. And so, I mean, again, as Adam said rightly, I think we're going to see where this election is in October. I think functionally it's a race between two pretty popular politicians. If the election ends up being a referendum on Trump, which looks like it's going to be, I just don't see how Scott gets there come November.
If I could just mangle that football metaphor for a little more, forgive me here, but is there sort of an analogy with the Eagles-Patriots here? I mean, could there be an outsider win in the offing?
I just first of all, I mean, Rick Scott is not an outsider anymore. I mean, he is the consummate insider. I mean, he's been governor of Florida for 8 years, and so and sort of ironically, I always find it funny that Scott, as much as been a creature of Washington, he likes being up there. He always enjoyed sort of, you know, using Obama as a foil. I mean, you'd see him at national, at the White House Press Correspondents Dinner and such. And so in no way is he an outsider. Again, I really just think this is a race that, you know, functionally, I don't care what the polls say. I think it's a 47-47, 48-48 race. There's going to be a lot of TV ads. As Adam said, it's going to be just a lot of noise. You know, but again, if we get to mid-October and Trump's approval rating nationally is still 41-42, I think that's going to matter more than pretty much anything else in this race.
We can talk a little more about the insider-outsider politics and who is the real outsider in this race in a little bit, but I want to get to a couple of calls here. We've got Ryan calling in. Ryan, you're on the air. What's on your mind thinking about the Senate race?
Thank you. I work in a job where I help people try to apply for Social Security benefits. So in that job, I see directly every day the effects of Governor Scott's decision not to expand Medicaid. Our clients are waiting a long, long time for their day with a hearing for Social Security, which is its own kind of separate issue in terms of what's going on with the government. But with Scott's decision not to help Floridians with Medicaid, we're seeing sick people unable to get medical treatment. I get calls sometimes that, unfortunately, my clients have passed during the wait. Mm-hmm. So it's a big problem. He had the chance to help Floridians or hurt President Obama, and he chose hurting President Obama in a politicized way over helping Floridians get medical treatment.
So it sounds like Medicaid is the big issue for you there, Ryan. Thank you so much for calling in. Sergio, I wonder if you want to pick up on that one. I mean, you were saying earlier that voters have kind of a short attention span, but if you are somebody in the position that our caller Ryan suggested that, you know, Medicaid is on your mind, maybe you have friends, relatives who are affected by this, or you work in that field, is that going to be one of the big issues here, do you think?
It's really hard to say it will, because I agree with with Steve and Adam, that it is going to be a referendum on Trump. And look, when given a choice, Florida voted for Trump in 2016, and the Affordable Care Act was talked about it at length. And as far as Medicaid expansion, they had a chance back in 2014 as well, given his position. But look, it's going to be a razor-thin margin either way, I think. But I don't see how maybe that issue is going to really outdo the gun issue because it's so fresh in people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Gun control, a big deal there. Adam Goodman, if I could come back to you for a moment, just on this issue of saying that you're running as an outsider. We heard those comments, some sound bites from the governor's launch yesterday, talked about the fact that he wants to shake up Washington. That's something that you do hear from a lot of politicians who are kind of running on that outsider ticket, but 7 years in Tallahassee, how much of an outsider is he? Can he really sort of take that label and run with it?
That's a great question. You would think no. In any normal conversation about politics, someone who's been in the position like Rick Scott has been as governor for nearly 8 years, suddenly saying, oh, by the way, I'm not one of them. I'm not a part of this system. It's a stretch argument. In reality, it's actually kind of true. Rick Scott came in as a true outsider. He didn't win because he was popular with the party or with the insiders. He just basically did something that's becoming more de rigueur today in terms of success in politics. He went straight to the consumer. He went straight to people with television. And he went over the heads of everybody, including his primary opponent, Bill McCollum, to get to where he is. And so I think that's a tough thing for him in terms of believability to market, that he is suddenly kind of just, you know, his own kind of guy. But I will say this much. In the last 6 to 12 months, Rick Scott, after what I think was a very, you might say, meandering term of office, has done very well. We tend to remember most what happened most recently. Mm-hmm. And on that front, I think Rick Scott comes into this race, at least, in pretty darn good shape. Now, the caller that just talked about Social Security and other issues like that, Scott's strength, obviously, is going to be on the economy, where he certainly did create jobs. And in terms of disaster relief, hurricane relief, I think he, well, almost every scorecard, did a tremendous job when the hurricane blew through here last year. Mm-hmm. But on the other fronts, education, I mean, he cut the teeth out of education in his first year in office. Transportation, he went against high-speed rail and other improvements, which has left much of the state in gridlock. Mm-hmm. And in terms of health care, the issue of, you know, the expansion of Medicaid. These are things where he's going to be vulnerable in terms of his sensitivity to people. And the last thing I'll say is, and I think Steve will probably reinforce this in a big way, the demographics in the state of Florida have changed dramatically since the last election. And I think the political dynamics and demographics have changed dramatically since Trump took office. Because of both of those factors, I think the governor, as close as this race may be, and we are used to close races, of course, in the state of hanging chads, as close as this race may be, I think the edge will end up going at this point to Senator Nelson, because he has the benefit of something he has to do nothing to take advantage of other than breathe there, and that's the president of the United States.
Adam Goodman there with Victory Strategies. Steve, what about that? I mean, it sounds like, you know, the race is going to be fairly tight. There's going to be a lot of money pumped into it from both sides. And of course, other races, too, which will be on people's minds, the governor's race, a pretty big one there, too. What about that sort of change in demographics, though? And just on the kind of the messaging, you know, the fact that he had the lieutenant governor of Puerto Rico alongside him at his launch yesterday, the fact that he was wearing his Navy hat. We saw that Navy hat in pretty much every single press conference that we saw during Irma. What about that sort of notion of Rick Scott as a senator sort of for the people of Florida and not just playing to his base?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, to the point about the closeness of the election, I mean, the last four major elections in Florida, the last two presidentials and the last two governor's races, have all been decided by a single point. So, again, I think, you know, there's no reason to think this election is not going to be in that same trajectory. If you see polls out there that have this race, one candidate or the other up 3, 4, 5, 6 poll points, I just don't think that's accurately where this race is going to be. I think it's just going to be hyper, hyper close. Again, just sort of exchange of television volleys. This would be a really good year to own a TV station in a place like Orlando. Mm-hmm. There's a pretty good chance you're going to end up with a second house in the Mediterranean after this year. But I'm not sure in the end it's going to matter, because I think the electorate here is so locked in. I mean, Florida, for its dynamism in terms of its population, is actually very stable politically. And for, you know, the population trends that look good for Democrats, i.e. some of the Puerto Rican migration, the Hispanics becoming more Democratic. At the same time, the improving economy around the country means that you're seeing more sort of traditional retirees move into Florida. So you're seeing population growth in places like the Villages. And mm-hmm. those things sort of balance each other out. So I wouldn't, if I'm a Democrat, I wouldn't get too excited about the demographics alone carrying it across the line. And I do think, as Adam said, I think in the last 12 months, Scott has done a very good job of controlling the things he can control, whether it's the hurricane, certainly on Parkland. I was actually involved a little bit with that. I mean, his office was really fantastic helping that bill get through. But that being said, I just don't think any of those things matter compared to Trump. And, you know, to that point real quick, I mean, I lived through this in reverse in 2010. It didn't really matter what Alex Sink said in that election against Rick Scott. It didn't matter. This Rick Scott had the Medicaid fraud. It didn't matter. He was proposing cuts in education. All that mattered in that cycle to the late deciding narrow slice of the electorate that decided that election was anger towards President Obama. And again, I think this election is very similar. If in October you're seeing Trump's numbers where they are today, that's going to matter more than guns, more than schools, more than Medicaid, more than, you know, you name it, just as it did in 2010.
I want to get a call in here. We've got Doug on the line. Doug, what are you thinking about hearing this conversation and thinking about your vote in November?
I just wanted to amplify. He just mentioned the Medicare fraud. I want everybody to remember that before this man was governor, he took the Fifth Amendment 175 times in a videotaped deposition because of the corruption of the organization he was running. And we have enough corruption with our president. We don't need another person going to Washington. Who's another corrupt person. So,
Doug, thank you for your call. Appreciate you you weighing in there. Just want to get a comment in here from Rory, who writes in on Twitter. I'm curious about Rick Scott's temperament. Jeb Bush never wanted to run for Senate because he saw himself as an executive, not one of 100. Wonder how, if elected, Governor Scott will handle the change. He's been an executive for so long. Sergio Bustos, what about that? I mean, if you're a senator, you do have to work with the Senate. You're not sort of the chief executive, so to speak. What are you seeing in the last little while that suggests that Rick Scott is kind of setting himself up for this transition? If he's elected to the Senate, he's going to have a different role. He's not going to be in charge of state anymore.
Yeah, I actually think it works better the other way around, being a senator than trying to be a governor. I'm sure with this idea of I'm going to fix Washington, I'm going to make Washington work. But if you're going with the idea like a lot of these senators have with that message, it seems like you have a lot of people up there who say it's all dysfunctional, but they don't really come up with a way to find some compromise, which is lacking in Washington on so many different issues. Mm-hmm. So many different issues. So I don't think that kind of message really sticks with people because of what Stephen Adams say, that it's a referendum on Trump. If anyone's a kind of disruptor, it's Donald Trump. And kind of you're witnessing that, whether you agree with Trump or disagree with him, the question is, can he get policies through Congress? And that just hasn't really happened except on the tax bill, which and I'm not sure how that's resonating with people, even though it is proving to be better for people's pocketbooks.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, too, just a kind of a reporter question. I mean, Governor Scott made his remarks. He left that campaign rally pretty quickly without taking questions. How open to reporters do you think a Senator Scott would be, Sergio Bustos?
Oh, I think he'd just be like the last 8 years. We were trying to catch him this morning. I think he was on CNN or one of the networks, and as usual, Scott's not a tremendous speaker. If you watched the speech last night, he had prepared remarks that he gave out, and he kind of stumbled through them. He just never really makes a point very clear. That said, he's got a very strong narrative. His life story is a good one. I'm just not sure it always comes out, given his enormous wealth. But I don't think he would be the same. Same as Senator. Difficult to kind of pin down. Goes back and forth on things and just not the strongest orator.
Mm-hmm. Steve Schale, if I could just ask you real quick. I mean, on that issue of, campaigning and the style of Rick Scott that we've seen over the last 7 years and what we might see in the next few months, how much of an evolution have you seen? And what do you think we might see further as he hits the campaign trail?
Yeah, I mean, I think he definitely evolved into the job of governor, but the way that he sort of deals with the media and deals with his public sort of face has not really changed. And as somebody who's been on the other side of it from a campaign standpoint, it's actually quite maddening. To his credit, I mean, he is religiously on message, and it's I think he has the view that if he only says one thing, that the media is only going to cover that one thing, And his ability to sort of suspend reality. I mean, to take Medicaid expansion. This is he's against Medicaid expansion. He was once for Medicaid expansion, and that was after he was against it the first time. So, his ability just to kind of compartmentalize where he is in the election, to say what the polling says he needs to say, and to never deviate from it. It's actually a challenge when you run against him because he really does not get off message very, very easily. And one of the things that the Nelson people are going to have to sort of guard against is the sort of the frustration of running against that kind of tactic. Mm-hmm. He's going to pick his path, Scott is, and if he thinks it's the best way to get to 50% plus one, he's going to go that direction, and it doesn't matter what the media or anybody else says about it.
Steve Schale, Democratic political strategist and president of Schale Strategies in Tallahassee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
Sergio Bustos is senior editor with Politico Florida. Thank you, Sergio.
Thank you.
And Adam Goodman, national GOP strategist and president of the Victory Group in Tampa, St. Pete. Adam, thank you again as well.
My pleasure.
Up next, what school kids can learn from the rodeo. Intersections, back in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Last Thursday, about 4,500 Osceola County school students got a taste of the rodeo at the Ram National Circuit Rodeo Finals in Kissimmee. From the Education Desk this week, we take a look at how rodeo fits into the school curriculum. I visited the Osceola Heritage Park and met with Osceola School Superintendent Deborah Pace, bull rider and Southeastern Circuit champion Michael Riggs, cattle rancher and school board member Ricky Booth, and middle school literacy resource teacher Janine Brocco.
Deborah, I want to start with you. How does this fit into the curriculum?
Well, it fits very, very nicely with both our English curriculum and our social studies curriculum in sixth grade. That's why we chose sixth graders. And Janine and the team in our middle school programs have really developed some solid lessons to give students a better sense of what rodeo is, but also why it's important here in Osceola County. It's such a big part of our heritage. You know, Ricky and I grew up with grandparents who were part of the founding members of the Silver Spurs Riding Club, a nonprofit organization that donates a lot back to kids, but starts with rodeo. And we're just excited to get to share it with our sixth graders.
Did you do this when you were a kid?
We did not get to do a sixth grade field trip, if that's what you mean, and I didn't actually get to compete in rodeo, but I rode in the Silver Spurs quadrille. We did square dance on horseback from the time I was elementary school all through high school. It's truly square dance formations that are done on horseback with partners. It's really pretty cool and exciting to see. Great fun to get to be a part of.
Michael, if I could bring you into this conversation, what are you going to be telling these kids?
Just going to be telling them what we do, kind of, and how we prepare. And I think rodeo is a good part of a children's life. You know, you get to go into rodeos, and it keeps you out of trouble, and it teaches you responsibility. So it's a really good aspect for children.
Where did you learn the craft of rodeo?
Actually, a friend of mine back home rode bulls, and I kind of started going with them, and just one thing led to another. So it was kind of a weird deal. There's not much rodeo where I'm from in Georgia, so it's just different.
Did they have programs in the schools in Georgia similar to what's going on here in Osceola County, where kids could get a taste of rodeo?
They do have the high school rodeo, and I don't know that any of the rodeos near us. There's not anything anywhere near this big in Georgia, but they do have the high school rodeos where they introduce the children to it at a younger age.
And do the kids actually learn some practical rodeo skills? Like, do you put them on the back of a horse or any of that kind of horse craft as part of this course? Or is it basically just here's what happens and you kind of explain a little bit about it?
It's just going to be here's what happens. This is what we do and how we do it. Some places we do have like barrels and stuff, and we'll put the kids on them and give them ropes and they can play with and stuff, just to kind of see if they like that kind of stuff, you know.
Because I imagine once they actually get to sort of the hands-on experience, they might be hooked.
Oh, yeah, some of them are. They really are, and that's the cool thing about it. You start them at a young age, and they can decide for themselves whether they want to do that or play football or play baseball. It's kind of what you're brought up around.
Okay, so Janine, if I could bring you into the conversation here, how do you design a curriculum or a lesson around rodeo? How does that work?
We always start with our Florida standards, and as Dr. Pace already mentioned, we do focus on our language arts standards and our social studies standards. From there, we are linking the content to what is happening today and the students' experience. We really want to give them a well-rounded informational text so that they understand the connection from the field trip to the curriculum.
Do some of them have some experience with, you know, what you're going to be telling them about anyway, just because they're from Osceola County and it's a big part of the heritage here?
We have many students who are coming from other locations outside of Osceola County, and even those students that are born in Osceola County may not be familiar. They're more from a suburban or city background, and they don't have the historical context. They are still young, so we do need to start with some foundation information and give them a historical context so that they understand how it connects to current day.
And is there a test at the end of it?
They do have some questions that are related to the standards. They're similar to our FSA test questions, and they will have those once they go back to their classroom.
And how long have you been doing this? How long has the field trip been part of the school curriculum?
This is our second year doing the field trip, so it is relatively new, but we've jumped in and the students are loving it.
Ricky Booth, it seems to me that if you expose a bunch of kids to rodeo, that could be a way to sort of keep this going, because things are changing here in Osceola County and in Central Florida, right? I mean, farming might not necessarily be the thing that people get into as a career path. The landscape is changing, so is this a way to keep that culture alive?
Absolutely. And it's not farms, it's ranches. We're a big cattle ranching county here in Osceola, actually still the largest cattle ranching county in the state of Florida. We're home to the largest cattle ranch in the whole United States of America, the Deseret Ranches, and some of the other top 10 are in the south part of our county. So we want to bring our kids out, show them this heritage. And Dr. Pace mentioned it before, if it wasn't for the Silver Spurs Club and what they did, and it wasn't just about rodeo for those group of people that started that organization, it was about creating an event as a fundraiser to give back to the community. You know, the first rodeo they did was to raise money for the war bond effort during World War II. So it's about that spirit of involvement, community engagement, volunteerism, and giving back. That, and if it wasn't for those folks with Silver Spurs, we wouldn't be standing here today having cowboys from California and Oregon and New York and Texas and Oklahoma gathering right here in Central Florida for their national circuit finals. So we're glad to have them here. We're glad that our kids get to be exposed to what makes our county so special.
What was your experience of rodeo, Ricky?
Just like Dr. Pace, I grew up riding in the quadrille, and Dr. Pace, she needs to give herself a little more credit because we both still volunteer for the Silver Spurs rodeos that happen here in February and June. So I've hauled stock around. I raised some bucking stock unsuccessfully most of the time, but I enjoy doing it. My uncle was the stock contractor and managed the stock here for the Silver Spurs Rodeo for a long, long time. Was an outstanding man, Doug Parton. So yeah, that was my involvement was in the organization, in the putting on, in the volunteering, in the working. So we certainly want to expose our kids to the great sport of rodeo, and also what is a big part of our heritage here in Osceola County.
Have you ever done anything like what Michael does professionally?
Yes, I can tell you as a child, I got on several bulls. You have to stay on for 8 seconds. I got on several bulls right here in the old arena that used to be here. Probably got on 3 bulls in my life, and my whole, you could probably count those seconds of about 4 seconds of total riding time on those 3 bulls. Actually, the last time I got on a bull was only because my cousin wouldn't get on his bull, and they were giving him a hard time and telling me I could be tougher than him if I'd go ahead and get on mine. So that's what I did. But I gave up my bull riding career when I was about 10 years old.
4 seconds doesn't sound long, but I'm sure when you're on the bull, it's an eternity, right?
The scariest part is nodding your head. The man next to me here, Mr. Riggs, he knows a lot more about that. He's been on a ton of bulls in his life. But to me, the scariest part is nodding your head. You know, it's adrenaline right after that.
What's it like then, riding a bull?
It's hard to explain. I guess the best way I could explain it is like being in a fight with somebody. It's kind of happening so fast, and your subconscious mind takes over. So it's like a survival type deal. We get on so many bulls that it's automatic to know what to do. So when the gate opens, like you said, it's a big nerve wracking, scary deal right up to the moment that you nod. And then once the gate opens, hopefully your body and your subconscious mind takes over, and it's a nice smooth ride, and you land on your feet and you win something.
What's the scariest experience you had on the back of a bull?
The scariest?
He has to think about it because there's been so many.
Yeah, it's scary all the time. I mean, if anybody says they're not scared or nervous, they're telling you a fib, but you kind of learn to deal with it. I'd say the scariest was a couple years ago at Texarkana. I got stepped on in the back, and I broke 10 ribs and punctured a lung, and you're crawling around out there trying to get up, and you don't know if you're going to be all right or not. You know, you're just trying to get up. I guess getting hurt like that is probably one of the scariest times I can remember.
There's someone else out there to try and distract the bull at that point, though, right?
Oh yeah, there's always at least 2 bullfighters and a barrel man, and all of them are, you know, their job is to come in and take the bull's attention from us, so we have an opportunity to get out of the arena safely.
So you must have racked up a few injuries in your career. Like, at a certain point, you think, okay, that's it. I can't do this any longer.
Actually, after that, like I said, I broke 10 ribs and punctured my lung from that accident, and I was in the hospital about 10 days, and I really thought hard and long about it then, you know, whether it was worth losing everything I had at home, being crippled for 2 or 3 months and not being able to work. It's a mental challenge to deal with injuries and come back, especially something like that, just really debilitating where you can't work or do anything when you go home. So, yeah, it's a mental struggle back and forth. It makes you think about it a lot.
Dr. Pace, where did the idea for bringing kids out to the rodeo come from?
This is really an example of the great partnerships that the school district and Osceola County have here in the community. The county obviously has invested heavily in bringing the Ram National Finals here to our county and Heritage Park, and they felt like, what could we do to also make sure that we have some great folks in the seats, but also to expose others to what, as Ricky and I both said, are such an important part of our heritage here in the district. You know, as Janine mentioned, we have kids from everywhere in our district. Over 100 different languages are spoken, 100 different countries represented, and for many of these kids, they would never have the opportunity to even think about what a rodeo is. And it's such an important example of great athleticism for both the cowboys and the cowgirls and the animals. But also, as Ricky said too, this idea of service and volunteerism. And Osceola County and the school board committed to allow us to do this. They've provided transportation. We have our food service team here. It's really all hands on deck from the school district to make this possible for our sixth grade students. But I will tell you, after last year's experience, it was something I knew we had to do again. The kids and the adults who came with them to chaperone and be a part of this were all so excited to have learned a little bit more about what rodeo is and about where our county started.
So Janine, is this here for the long haul, do you think? Is it part of what Osceola County Schools does from here on out?
I think it needs to be. I think it would be a great experience for our students to continue as they enter middle school to continue to be part of this. When we are able to bring students together across the entire school district from all of their backgrounds, experiences, and all of our middle schools, it really is a bonding experience. It helps the students see that continuity in our curriculum and really helps them to bond and have a common experience together and be able to share that with one another, not only our students, but our teachers as well.
That was Osceola County Middle School Literacy Resource Teacher Janine Bracco. We also heard from school board member Ricky Booth, Superintendent Deborah Pace, and bull rider Michael Riggs. Still to come, counting homeless youth in Central Florida. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Last October, the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness teamed up with researchers at the University of Chicago to conduct a count of homeless youth in Orange, Seminole, and Osceola counties. It's the first time there's been a tri-county survey of homeless youth. For more on what the census revealed and what's next, we're joined by Shelley Lawson and Dr. Matthew Morton. Well, Shelley Lawson is the CEO of the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. Shelley, thank you so much for joining us.
Matthew, it's always a pleasure to be on your show.
And Matt Morton is the principal investigator at Voices of Youth Count and a research fellow at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. Thanks for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Matthew.
So, Shelley, if you just start us off, what did the census uncover? What sort of numbers came back, and were you surprised by what you found?
So what we found, I believe, quantified what we knew in our guts, but now we have some background information to really help us quantify some of the issues and opportunities. So we actually, with 100 volunteers, we were able to identify 268 young people between the ages of 13 and 24, and 155 of them agreed to actually engage with our survey. But again, 268 young people, 13 through 24, 12% of those were under the age of 18.
And just to be clear, I mean, because there are homeless families, right? So these would be young people who were out on the streets on their own.
These are unaccompanied youth, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Matt Morton, when you're confronted with a number like that, what do you do next? Because it sounds like this is kind of, in some ways, a new way of looking at homelessness, zeroing in on homeless youth.
Absolutely. You know, youth experiencing homelessness are often hidden. They're invisible. Young people don't want others to know that they're experiencing homelessness. They don't want to be defined by that. And so these aren't young people that are just readily presenting themselves to systems and services and saying, I'm homeless. So you really have to take coordinated efforts like this involving a lot of local organizations and young people themselves to identify these young people and to help them feel comfortable with reporting their situation. And so that's why these numbers are so important, because they help the community really rally around the issue of youth homelessness. And this is distinct from other forms of adult or family homelessness. Adolescents and young people are in a unique developmental stage in the life cycle, and homelessness really impacts their ability to develop social-emotional skills and key opportunities that will support them throughout their lifetime. So it's important to focus on this group specifically. And I think a couple of things are clear from the data about where we can go next. First of all, there's a significant shortage in the housing stock, specifically for young people. There are 104 beds that we identified, or housing spaces specifically for youth experiencing homelessness on a given day, while we identified 268 young people experiencing homelessness. So you've got a significant shortage of just basic services and housing options for these young people. So it's really important that the community has the opportunity to really develop the types of housing options that are appropriate for youth, because a 19-year-old young person doesn't feel comfortable sharing a space with 40-year-old, 50-year-old individuals experiencing homelessness in many cases. I think the second point that is important is that we saw very high percentages of young people experiencing homelessness who had also been in juvenile or criminal justice systems and who had been in foster care systems. This is important because it highlights other major public systems that are contacting young people experiencing homelessness. They're coming into reach with these young people, and these systems have the opportunity to collaborate with the homelessness systems to make sure that we're identifying these young people early in their homelessness experiences or before they ever happen, and making sure that they're connected with the supports and the services they need right away.
If I could bring you back into this conversation then, Shelley Lawson, I mean, talking about the need for housing that's geared specifically to young people, is the county, Orange County and other surrounding counties, are they working on developing some housing specifically for homeless youth?
Well, we are in a situation across all populations of those experience homelessness where we don't have enough housing. And I think for youth, the unaccompanied youth especially, we just don't have enough. I think these numbers allow us now to start putting some plans together on some more strategic emphasis on housing for those experiencing the young people, unaccompanied youth. One big concern for me as well is only 10% of our beds actually are used for people under the age of 18. So that's another key place. And there are barriers to housing the 13 through 18-year-old that as a community we're going to have to start talking about, thinking about. Some of them are policies established at the state and local level. So it's a really complex issue, but housing becomes, in my mind, just a really important focus for us.
Matt Morton, if you're a homeless youth, what are your chances of becoming a homeless adult, and how do you break that cycle?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that the Australians have found in a really interesting study is that the single greatest pathway into adult homelessness is youth homelessness. And I don't think a lot of people really realize that and the importance of that, because it really means that if we're going to address the homelessness challenge overall in our nation, we really need to start young and addressing these issues as they're emerging with young people and making sure that they have access to safe and stable housing and the supports that they need. It also, I think, is important to highlight that not all young people have the same risk of experiencing homelessness. And the Central Florida data really show this. Black and African American youth, for example, were 42% of youth experiencing homelessness. About a third of the young women experiencing homelessness were pregnant and parenting, and 35% of youth that were experiencing homelessness identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer. And so these are groups that are disproportionately affected by this challenge, and our systems and services, both in Central Florida but really nationally, need to be responsive to these specific subpopulations and making sure that we're addressing their needs.
Which parts of the country are doing this well? I'm wondering if there's somewhere in the country where Central Florida could be looking for some examples of how to tackle this problem.
You know, we're having a lot of good conversations around that now in Central Florida, and I think it's a great question. One of the exciting things that's going on nationally is that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has youth homelessness demonstration grants that it is awarding to a number of communities across the country to demonstrate how they can end youth homelessness with coordinated community responses like what Central Florida is looking to do. And in Travis County, Texas, that's Austin, for example, they started with a youth count with our team, much like this one. And based on that initial data, they rallied the community around a 100-day challenge to meet short-term goals and get all of the collaborators at the table to address youth homelessness issues in the short term. And then based on that, they received one of these U.S. government grants to develop a more long-term coordinated response to youth homelessness. And that involves pieces like what Shelley and I were talking about, assessing young people in a coordinated way, making sure that there's no wrong door for youth experiencing homelessness, and then providing the right set of services and supports to the right young person at the right time based on their overall coordinated system of care.
Shelley Lawson, is the next step for you to try and go after some federal funding?
Actually, the Homeless Services Network has pulled a group together, and they're the operating group that manages all the service providers. They actually, we are working together now to go after a federal, just like Dr. Morton just talked about. Additionally, we think there are some short-term ways, rather than waiting for the federal government, where the local community can help us support a short-term coordinated digital system where, again, there's a built platform where there's no wrong door, not only unaccompanied youth, but for the service providers. Because I think one of the big ahas that we got out of working together is how many service providers who are looking across the desk at a young person in need of a service that one service provider might not be able to provide them had no idea how to support that young person's need at that moment in time.
Shelley Lawson, are you going to be doing the census again next year? Will this become an annual thing as well?
That's something we're talking about. We really want to first start taking some action on what we've learned to date before we assess whether or not this is something we do on an annual basis. Maybe we do it every 3 years. How do we use this data in a way to really inform our actions is really our target for the next year or so.
Well, Shelley Lawson is the CEO of the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. Thank you so much for joining us, Shelley.
Thank you, Matthew.
And Matt Morton, Principal Investigator at Voices of Youth Count and Research Fellow at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. Matt, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Danielle Pryor answered the phones. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. We're on the NPR One app, and you can download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.